Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Sex and Sexuality in Ancient Rome by L.J. Trafford, narrated by Jennifer M. Dixon. Introduction. There is a certain image of ancient Rome that prevails in the modern mind, one of a city soaked in depravity and decadence, a sexual free-for-all, where anyone could do anything to anyone they wanted, an empire whose lack of morality was the catalyst for its decline and, ultimately, its fall, at least according to Edward Gibbon. This sinful city picture is somewhat ratified by what the surviving sources and archaeological artefacts have to say. There is biographer Suetonius' frankly eye-popping account of what the Emperor Tiberius got up to on the island of Capri. The first century CE poet, Martial, whose subject matters include a rant on his girlfriend refusing to let him sodomize her, grey pubic hair, and a claim that an acquaintance is handing out dinner party invitations based solely on penis size. Elsewhere, the great unpublished can be seen expressing their sexual complaints, comments, boasts on the walls of Pompeii and Herculaneum. We are told that the gladiator Saladus makes all the girls moan, that Theophilus performs oral sex on women, and then there is the anonymous soul who believed the walls of a local villa were the perfect place to confess to his fellow townsfolk, "I have buggered men." Even religion wasn't exempt from this bawdiness. The gods themselves partook in adultery, incest, and even bestiality, all of which were represented in the art of the era, along with a multitude of depictions of the male sexual organ on walls, pavements, in shrines, homes, above shop doorways, and on jewellery. Naples Museum has a secret cabinet of artefacts from Pompeii and the surrounding area that were deemed too shocking to be seen by regular tourists. Visiting this secret cabinet was to be confronted with hundreds of terracotta penises, alongside frescoes of couples entwined in lovemaking, and a truly stupendous statue of the god Pan having it away with a goat. Sex was very much on public display in ancient Rome. It was depicted in art, discussed in poetry, scrawled on walls, and used in politics to smear your opponent. Is it any wonder we see ancient Rome as a 400-year-long orgy? But is this a true portrait of a society? Rome, at its height in the first century CE, was home to 1 million people. It would be very surprising if they all held the same views on any topic, including sex and sexuality. In fact, if you dig a little deeper beneath the in-your-face depictions of penises on every street corner and explicit frescoes, the story gets a lot more complex. Despite being a society lacking the Christian notion of sexual sin, Rome was far from being a free-for-all. There were constraints, both social and legal, on sexual behaviour. In Sex and Sexuality in Ancient Rome, we shall delve into these rules, learning what was expected sexual behaviour for both men and women, and whether the reality matched the ideal. We shall discuss what was understood about sex, procreation, and contraception in the ancient world, examine what was truly taboo in the bedroom, and explore why there are quite so many penises depicted in Pompeii. Leave your preconceptions at the door, and let us get into bed with the Romans. Chapter 1. Language. Those of a delicate sensibility would be wise to abandon this book now, for we are going to delve into how the ancient Romans talked about sex. Fruity is not the word. Think more of a thumping great plank to the face. Words were not minced, they were hurled aggressively toward their target. But it is an important topic to start with, for it helps explain much about Roman society that we will discuss later, including why such extreme stories of sexual depravity attach themselves to emperors, and how female sexuality was viewed. So, buckle up, and maybe make sure nobody else is listening as we closely examine how the ancient Romans talked about sex. You have been warned. The poem begins the same as it ends. I will bugger you and fuck your mouths. The you in question are Aurelius and Furius, whom the poet Catullus dubs as the pansy and the pervert. What had they done to inflame him so? If you're expecting some grievous attack on a member of Catullus' family, possibly a fatal one, downgrade that expectation now, for what has upset Catullus is a criticism that his poems, which detail his great love for a woman he calls Lesbia, are unmanly. This fucking in the mouth, in Latin, irumo, is a threat tossed out by Catullus for all manner of offences. When he suspects Aurelius of having designs on a boy that he, Catullus, is seeing, he warns, "I will get you first by fucking your mouth." He addresses to an entire tavern of men, whom he accuses of sleeping with his girl, "Do you think I wouldn't date fuck all your mouths as you just sit there, all 200 at once?" Then there's the time he threatens the same Aurelius with having a radish and mullet fish shoved up his bum, the traditional Roman punishment for a male adulterer caught by a wronged husband, amongst other indignities. All of which might lead us to conclude that Catullus is way too sensitive for his own good and should probably stay away from wine for a bit. But this extreme sexually aggressive language is not limited to Catullus' broken heart. It pops up all over the place in Rome. In 41 BCE, a war broke out between Octavian, later known as the Emperor Augustus, and Mark Antony's wife, Fulvia. While Antony was out east playing with Cleopatra, Fulvia was keeping an eye on Octavian's activities in Rome and ensuring Antony's interests were taken care of. Several authors attribute the war Fulvia declared on Octavian as a tactic to entice Antony away from his Egyptian queen lover, underlining the irrationality of women as Roman men saw it. During this conflict, the armies of Fulvia and Antony's brother Lucius were besieged at Perugia. To break the siege, Octavian's army brought in their slingshotters. These men would hurl stones at the enemy at great velocity, using a length of leather that they spun around their heads before releasing. Experts have calculated that the speed these stones were projected at could reach 100 miles per hour, making them a lethally effective weapon. Archaeologists have also found examples of slingshots with holes drilled into them, which would have caused the stones to whistle as they shot through the air. Multiply these stones by the hundreds, and it must have been an unnerving sound, a further attempt at intimidating the enemy. Eerie and unsettling whistling noise aside, there was one further tactic the Roman slingshotters used to threaten their opponents. Words. Inscribed on the stones found from the siege of Perugia are some extremely barbed insults, and they come from both armies. "Hi, Octavian, you suck cock," is the cheerful greeting on one such stone. Heading in the other direction, we find, "I'm aiming for Fulvia's cunt." Then there are such charming suggestions as, "Bald Lucius Antonius, and you too, Fulvia, open up your assholes," and, "You pansy Octavian, sit on this one." It is quite amazing that one side of this war of filthy words will end up as Rome's great moral master, lecturing all about how good Romans should behave. For the pansy Octavian, who allegedly sucked cock and was aiming his forces directly at Fulvia's vagina, has a personality change in his 30s and emerges from a cocoon as Augustus, Rome's first emperor. One of Augustus' crusades, as we shall learn later in the book, was cleaning up Roman morals and returning Rome to a golden age where young men didn't make up little ditties about married women, they happen to be at war with, such as this one, which is allegedly accredited to Octavian. Because Antony fucks Glaphyra, Fulvia fixed this punishment for me, that I should fuck her too. That I should fuck Fulvia? What if Manius begged me to bugger him? Would I do it? No, if I had any sense. Another source of this kind of heavy-duty insulting comes via the graffiti found at Pompeii and Herculaneum. In Pompeii alone, over 11,000 different samples have been found, which give us quite an insight into the concerns of the Pompeian town folk. There are election posters and advertisements, but also many examples like this one. "Weep, you girls, my penis has given you up. Now it penetrates men's behinds. Goodbye, wondrous femininity." There are accusations that, apparently, Phileros is a eunuch, and Atimetus has got a girl up the duff. Boasts about sexual congress frequently make the walls. Apelles Mus and his brother had a good night with two girls who they both had sex with twice, we discover. Less successful was Floronius, who tells us he is with the 7th Legion and that the women did not know of his presence. Only 6 women came to know, too few for such a stallion. Poor Floronius. Although we don't know the exact literacy figure for ancient Rome, we do know it was higher than many other time periods, which does beg the question whether these pieces of graffiti were restricted to the lower and presumably coarser classes of the town. Not so, because some of the graffiti found is not on the outside of buildings, but rather on the inside of some very nice houses indeed. Then there is this piece from Herculaneum. "Apollinaris, the doctor of the emperor, Titus, defecated well here." If the doctor, to an emperor, a very eminent position, felt it fully acceptable and even desirable to let everyone know where he'd done a poo, I think we can safely assume that the Romans' everyday use of language might have veered to the coarse side. As well as being coarse, to our modern sensibilities, the words used served a particular purpose. Take the example of Decimus Valerius Asiaticus, who, on being charged with effeminacy under the reign of Claudius, retorted to the prosecutor, "Ask your son, Sulius," he said. "They will confirm my masculinity." This suggests that sodomizing Sulius' sons was proof against any charges of unmanly behaviour. It's not unlike that Catullus opening line we began this chapter with. It's not the words used, it's the aggressive, threatening nature of them that is very Roman. It's hardly surprising that a city with the largest standing army in the known world, which it had used to conquer a large chunk of Europe, North Africa, and the Near East, was a society that was aggressively male, and the type of insults used reflect this. Threatening sexual indignities, indeed humiliation, to your enemies was the Roman way of proving their manhood. It is worth remembering that for Roman legionaries, one of the perks of sacking an enemy city was license to rape the inhabitants, be they male or female, an aggressive humiliation of the defeated city. There was a sliding scale of insulting words, from the mild to the extremely offensive, that might be employed in any situation, be it a poem, words scrawled on a wall, a political speech, a public trial, or, we must strongly assume, verbally. Insults were based on the notion of assertive and passive, of penetrating and of being penetrated. To be assertive and to penetrate was to be a man. To be passive and penetrated was to be a woman or womanish. The scale of offensiveness lay in the method of penetration, and the language reflects this. To assert one's masculinity was to penetrate or fuck, futuo. This was an act solely ascribed to the male. Men could also pedicare, penetrate an anus. If you wanted to take the offensiveness level higher, you could call another man a siniadus or a catamite, These were men who gained enjoyment through being penetrated. To be called either, therefore, was an accusation of being unmanly and effeminate. There was also an accompanying gesture to these accusations, which involved scratching the head with a particular finger. In the 50s BCE, professional troublemaker Publius Clodius had a mob follow round Pompey the Great, and, acting rather like a Greek chorus, they would shout out questions such as, "Who is a licentious imperator? Who scratches his head with one finger?" and then yell their answer, "Pompey!" We are told that Pompey found this annoying and took to hiding in his house to avoid the singing mob. There's a barbed insult from Cicero on Julius Caesar in a similar vein to the Pompey one. "When I look at his hair, which is arranged with so much nicety, and see him scratching his head with one finger, I cannot think that this man would ever conceive of so great a crime as the overthrow of the Roman constitution," which is a fancy way of saying Cicero didn't think Julius Caesar was man enough to make himself dictator and follow the political path he did. Irritatingly, we don't know which finger had to be used for the gesture to reach the full offensiveness level. Similarly mysterious are the continued references to the use of the left hand, which appears to suggest masturbation. A graffiti from Pompeii reads, "When my worries oppress my body, with my left hand I release my pent-up fluids." The first century CE poet, Martial, makes more than one reference to the left hand, noting that if his girlfriend does not turn up, then his left hand helps him out in her place. He also accuses a certain Ponticus of a rather sterile love life, where his left hand serves as his mistress, all of which suggests that Romans practiced masturbation only with their left hand. Why the left hand? It's probably to keep the right hand free from pollution. Romans associated their right hands with noble activities, such as handshaking, signing important papers, and gesticulating wildly in important political speeches. Another body part that Romans did not want to pollute was the mouth, which they considered sacred. There were all kinds of associated reasons why. The mouth was used in religious incarnations, in politics, in oath-making, and in all kinds of sacred duties. Also, a standard Roman greeting involved kissing, so you really needed to be sure where that mouth had been. To be penetrated in the mouth was worse and far more shameful than being penetrated in the anus. It made you a fellator. Defiling your mouth in such a fashion was viewed as particularly dirty, as hinted at in this martial epigram. "Zoilus, why sully the bath by bathing in it your lower extremities? It could only be made more foul, Zoilus, by your plunging your head in it." But there was a level beneath being called a fellator that was even worse, the real lowest of the low. The absolute worst insult you could hurl at a Roman man was to accuse him of being a cunus lingere. It doesn't really need translating. It's the double whammy of insults, because not only are you defiling your mouth, you're being penetrated by the genitals of a woman. This makes you doubly passive. All of which means that the persons unknown who scrawled this on a Pompeii wall, "Theophilus, don't perform oral sex on girls against the city wall like a dog," really did not like Theophilus and wanted to shame him in front of the whole town. Who knows, perhaps Theophilus got his revenge and scrawled a suitably nasty retort on some other wall in that town. Having listened this far, you will be unsurprised to learn that Latin has no fewer than 120 different words for penis. A sopio was a grotesquely oversized penis, like you see on the god Priapus. At the opposite end of the scale, pipina was babyish talk for the male organ, something like pee-pee. You may have noticed that all the aforementioned insults are geared towards men, all linked to use or non-use of male appendages. But there is something else at work here, and it is linked to two specific Latin words, virtus and stuprum. Both are difficult words to satisfactorily translate into English, and we shall be discussing them in far greater detail later, but very roughly, virtus was a collection of attributes that made up the ideal Roman man, and stuprum was a shameful act punishable by law. To commit stuprum was to put your virtus in danger. Humiliation and public shaming are the twin powers lurking in the insults and language we'd noted earlier. But what of women? Were they subject to the same degree of sexually aggressive insults? The offensiveness level of Roman insults, as we have noted, is based on whether someone is behaving passively or actively in bed, based on the notion that to be a Roman male was to be dominant and active. The good Roman woman, as we shall learn in a later chapter, was chaste and passive, and insults and offence directed at women tend to question these proper feminine traits. Cicero, for example, accuses the high-born Claudia of being a violent and impudent whore. Fulvia, who we met earlier in this chapter, behaves not as a woman ought to. She was a woman who took no thought for spinning or housekeeping, nor would she deign to bear sway over a man of private station. But she wished to rule a ruler and command a commander. Tacitus is clear that a woman who has parted with her virtue will not refuse other demands. The sliding scale of insults directed at women moves from questioning their chastity to accusing them of being a literal prostitute. Once chastity has been compromised, as Tacitus comments earlier, then anything is possible of that woman. I would like to apologize for the explicit content of this first chapter. I'm aware that I might have eased you into the subject more gently, but hopefully you have picked up some of the key themes and words relating to how the Romans both viewed and referred to sexual practices. We shall be returning to these ideals and ideas repeatedly as we continue on our quest to understand sex and sexuality in ancient Rome. Chapter 2. Controlling Desire, A Brief History of Morality Laws. After that first chapter, you may be forgiven for thinking that the ancient Romans were a bunch of very potty-mouthed sex obsessives. Maybe so, but there is another important element at work here, and that is judgment. All those insults hurled about are designed to cast suspicion on the victim's character by the sex acts they were alleged to enjoy. Your private life is seen to be very much linked to your public life and your suitability for it. It is here we run into an element of ancient Rome that might surprise you. It was a deeply conservative and moralistic society. There was a strong notion of what was a decent and proper way to live, and successive emperors brought in laws to force the population to adhere to these standards, with admittedly mixed results. Private morals were of concern to both the state and the public, as we shall discover. Rome was a moral cesspool, that was evident to many. For the satirist Juvenal, it was a city where men wore makeup, women achieved a happy ending, courtesy of the local masseur, schoolboys were complicit in adultery, and slaves serviced both master and mistress. Cato the Elder was of the firm view that the city needed a proper cleansing. Cicero was distressed that the old virtues had been so forgotten that they barely appeared in books. Pliny the Elder saw a Rome where people cultivated each other's vices rather than their good qualities. The historian Tacitus looked wistfully at the barbarian Germans and declared that no one there finds vice amusing or calls it up to date to seduce and be seduced. In his introduction to his epic retelling of Rome's history, Livy was clear in what he considered the lessons of the past that he wished to pass on. Let him follow the decay of the national character, observing how at first it slowly sinks, then slips downward more and more rapidly, and finally begins to plunge into headlong ruin, until he reaches these days in which we can bear neither our diseases nor their remedies. Clearly something had gone terribly wrong with Rome, but when had this rot set in? The historian Sallust decides the rotting point was when the dictator Sulla took over Rome in the 80s BCE. Juvenal looks fondly back at the era of the Second Punic War between Rome and Hannibal. This, he decides, was a vice-free era because the men were busy fighting the Carthaginians and the women, therefore, were worn out from keeping things going in their absence. Writing a biography of the great Roman general Aemilius Paulus, Greek author Plutarch declared that this was an age when there were so many great and outstanding men of that glory and virtue were thick on the ground. Interestingly, the Second Punic War and the ascendancy of General Aemilius Paulus both take place within the lifetime of Cato the Elder, who was convinced that he was living in a time of great immorality. Clearly, this golden age was one that never really existed, but Romans clung on to it and wished desperately to return to it, whether they were living like Cato in the days of the Roman Republic, 700 BCE to 28 BCE roughly, or under the emperors of the 1st and 2nd centuries CE, as Livy, Juvenal and Pliny were. Although Romans couldn't agree when their city's descent into immorality and vice had begun, they did all agree how it had come about, because of the wealth that flooded into Rome from her empire. The philosopher Seneca muses that when men become rich, they become more concerned with their appearance and obsessive about home improvements, how to make the walls glitter with marble that has been imported overseas, how to adorn a roof with gold so that it may match the brightness of the inlaid floors. It's all a bit grand designs. In the Roman mindset, there is no distinction between excesses in luxury and wealth and excesses in sex and sexual deviances. We see repeatedly in texts from the era how closely Romans associated licentious behaviour with luxury. Cato the Elder ran for the office of censor on a platform of cauterizing the hydra like diseases of luxury and effeminacy. The one, to Romans, led inexorably to the other. For Pliny, his contemporaries' obsession with the acquiring wealth had led them to abandon the pursuit of knowledge and the begetting of children. Juvenal's view was that the desire for money had caused all to abandon sexual chastity, whether they be schoolboys or brides, matrons or widows. In describing Eppia, a well-brought-up lady who eloped with a gladiator, Juvenal says of her, "She was luxury-reared, cradled by daddy in Swansdown, brought up to frills and flounces. The luxury she had experienced had softened her towards sexual immorality." Women were often on the receiving end of these concerns about the corrupting nature of luxury and wealth. Pliny the Elder recounts seeing the Empress Lollia Paulina, wife to Caligula, attending an ordinary banquet heaped in jewels worth 40 million sesterces. Then there is the fanciful story of Cleopatra dissolving a pearl in vinegar and drinking it in order to win a bet that her dinner would cost 10 million sesterces. In 215 BCE, an attempt was made to limit the amount of money that women could spend on themselves. The Lex Oppia restricted women to possessing no more than half an ounce of gold and forbade them from wearing overly colourful clothing. It was argued that women, given a free rein to their undisciplined nature, to this untamed animal, and then expect them to set a limit on their own license. The law was repealed in 100.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?